Welcome to State of the State, the monthly roundup of policy and research for the state of Michigan, brought to you by the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State and the good folks here at WKAR Studios. I'm Arnold Weinfeld, Interim Director for the Institute, and as always, I'm joined by MSU economist Dr. Charlie Ballard, who directs our State of the State survey. And later on, Dr. Sheila Cotton, an MSU Foundation professor in the Department of Media and Information at Michigan State, will join us as well. Dr. Cotton studies the use and social impacts of technology, and most recently has been studying the impact of automation and automated vehicles both in the workforce and on various segments of the population. As well, she assists in a campus-wide cross-disciplinary effort on regarding socio-mobility. So we'll be talking all things mobility and autonomous vehicles in the near future. But before we speak to Dr. Cotton, Charlie, let's dive into the latest news from the world of policy and politics here in the state of Michigan. Since our last discussion, I think it's safe to say the topic with the biggest focus has been the governor's proposed 45-cent gas tax increase. This to address what is well known to be a $2.5 billion need to fix Michigan's roads and bridges. Now, as you know, generally speaking, this would be a tough sell. But the last few weeks, it may have gotten tougher as we've seen a rise in gas prices.
Yes.
And the Michigan Association of United Ways released their most recent ALICE report. ALICE standing for Asset Limited, Income Constrained.
But Employed.
And this report covers Michigan households across the state, where we found once again that over 40% of Michigan households either had incomes below the poverty level or didn't earn enough to make ends meet.
Right.
So what do you make of the United Ways recent report? You've studied economic issues facing Michigan citizens vis-a-vis this well-known need for additional revenue to meet our infrastructure needs.
Well, the ALICE report, I think, is very important input into our public policy conversation in Michigan and really across the country. And what we're seeing is the continuation of a trend that's been going on for 40 years. It was in the late 70s, early 80s that we began this historically unprecedented increase in income inequality. Our economy is twice as big as it was back then, but the increased income has accrued overwhelmingly to those at or near the top of the income distribution. And what that means is a lot of people have been left behind. One small piece of good news is that the last 4 years or so have been decent years for job growth and income growth. And so it's remarkably not as bad as it used to be. It's only a few years ago that we were just inching out of the Great Recession. But still, a lot of households not doing very well. You said the ALICE, Asset Limited, Income Constrained But Employed. So that's a group that we might call the working poor, or the working not quite poor, but not doing very well. The official poverty line for a family of four is about $24,000. But the ALICE report says, look, let's be serious. If you've got a family of four, $24,000, that's $2,000 a month? Mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to have a halfway decent place to live for four people, you'd really like to have more than one bedroom. Finding that, you can't find that for $400 a month. And then there's the cost of childcare, the cost of health insurance if you don't have employer-provided health insurance. And, of course, there's the cost of maintaining a vehicle, which fits into this whole issue of the gas tax. And the gas tax, as you know, that's going to take a larger fraction out of a low-income family's budget than a high-income family's budget. One thing that sort of points in the other direction, getting your front rims replaced also takes a higher fraction of a low-income family's budget. Mm-hmm. So it's a mix. And, of course, some people who are low-income don't have a vehicle, and so that puts, if they're taking the bus, that puts them sort of into a different category. But the long-term income inequality is definitely a concern. Yeah. And I hope one that we will address more as we go forward.
Right. And, of course, the unique thing about what the Michigan Association of United Ways does with the Alice Report is that it looks at every county.
Yes.
And it goes through those various pieces that you talked about, healthcare costs, living costs in terms of renting or owning a home, transportation costs, and it looks at it for every county for families and for single individuals as well. And it not only talks about households, but I also saw where it once again found that over 60% of the new jobs being created here in the state are $20 and under.
Right.
And so you can do the math on that as well and find that, say, for a family, you'd really need both mom and dad working at that $20 an hour rate to be able to sustain a quality of life that allows them to have health insurance, keep the car running, put clothes on the kids, and food on the table.
Yes, the median household nationwide is making in the 50s or 60s. That means half of the households are less than that. And there was a time when I thought that $60,000 was a lot of money. Not so much anymore, mm-hmm. as prices have gone up in the last few decades. Now, one aspect of the governor's proposal would be an increase in the earned income tax credit. We established an earned income tax credit, which is a subsidy to the earnings of low-income households. We established that in federally back in 1975, but then many states have topped that off. And we started that in 2007. Then it was dramatically scaled back in 2011. Her proposal is to go back, not all the way to what it was, but to increase it. That would take some of the sting out of all the costs that are faced by low and middle income families.
And that's a good point. I did have the opportunity to see the governor's budget presentation. One of the things she's been doing is going around the state to make her case about not just the gas tax, but her budget proposals. And it's very well done. A lot of it are the facts on the economy that you've talked about before. She talks about not just her transportation proposal, but her education and talent or workforce development proposals. And as you just noted, those strategies to help offset, in some instances, you know, the sting of what would be a phased in gas tax. But my guess is that this is going to be a hard sell in Michigan as we move down the road in 2019 and look toward the 2020 election cycle as well.
Yes.
President Trump was here in the state yesterday.
Yes.
We've had some of the Democratic candidates for president visiting the state over the last couple of weeks. I think it's safe to say that Michigan and the Midwestern states and those key states from the last election, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, are going to get a lot of attention.
Well, Hillary Clinton's campaign ignored Michigan until the very end of the election cycle in 2016, and the results were not favorable. And I think the Democrats have learned their lesson from there, and they're having their national convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I think they're going to put a lot of resources into the upper Midwest. You know, this region of the country is a region where we have struggled with. A big part of it is the long-term decline of manufacturing. And in a few minutes with Dr. Cotton, we're going to be talking about mobility, thinking about mostly about physical mobility and the implications of that. But some very important research has been done in recent years by Raj Chetty of Stanford and Harvard and various co-authors on income mobility, and it's not a pretty picture. The American myth is of rags to riches. If you work hard, you can pull yourself up. In fact, we are one of the least mobile intergenerationally. of the affluent countries, much less than the Scandinavian countries, much less than Canada. And by intergenerational mobility, I mean the ability of a young person to move up and to do better than his or her parent. Chetty's research shows that of Americans born in 1940, 92% of them did better than their parents, almost all. Of Americans born in 1980, who are now nearing their 40th birthday, only half of them are doing better than their parents were doing at a similar part of their life. And the losses have been biggest among the middle class and biggest in the upper Midwest. And that's right here in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And that is a that's not a, a news story, but it's one that this Alice report adds to. There are a lot of families in Michigan that have not benefited very much, if at all, from the economic growth that we have seen. I mean, our economy is bigger, CEOs are doing fine, and a lot of other highly skilled, well-placed people are doing well. But the average Joe and Jane, not sharing all that much in that prosperity.
So there continue to be challenges.
Absolutely.
I think the governor's budget proposal tries to lay those out for us and begin that discussion. Certainly one of the challenges moving forward that we've already started to see is changes in the workplace due to automation. And certainly that's going to have an impact on our lives moving forward and on the workplace. And so let's, with that, turn now to Dr. Sheila Cotton. As I mentioned, her most recent research has involved both the impact of automation and automated vehicles in the workplace. And with a grant from IPSR's Michigan Applied Public Policy Research Program, looking at autonomous vehicles and the impact on various populations. And Sheila, as I mentioned, you're assisting in a lead role with our social mobility group across campus. So there's a lot going on in this space that you're involved with. So why don't you tell us a bit more about those projects?
Thanks so much for having me today. We have several different projects going on at MSU with a range of researchers across the university to examine mobility issues very broadly. So I am one of the co-leaders, if you will, of a group called Sociomobility, and it's thinking beyond the engineering and beyond the technology to what are the social, behavioral, communication, legal, economic impacts of mobility that are playing out in our society today. So we have sociologists, we have economists, we have lawyers, we have planners, geographers, a range of different faculty who all come together once a month to talk about issues around mobility and how can we better understand this changing mobility era that we're in, and what are the impacts on people's lives and on society more generally. And so we have people that are studying the electronic scooters that we're seeing all over town and all over campus, to studying AVs, to studying railway, a range of different aspects of technology development and implementation. We also have some engineers in our group to help us better understand some of the technological aspects of these different deployments that are going on around the world. But it's an interesting group, and I really think we're at the forefront of examining the socio-mobility aspects of the different devices that are being developed.
And for the second year in a row, here in May, we're going to bring that group of faculty from MSU, from outside of MSU, and practitioners from both the public and private sector together in a convening to try and figure out what are their issues that they would that need additional research. That's going to be taking place here on campus. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. It'll be in early May at the Henry Center, and we're really looking to have a range of different community organizations, from auto industries to AARP to a range of different groups that are interested interested in mobility, either from developing technologies to working with different populations across the state, to help us better understand what are the challenges, what are the needs, and how can we as a university really work with these organizations to try to help solve some of the problems that exist today.
So let's chat a bit about your own work here. Last August, you came out with a report through the American Center for Mobility, led a study that was supported also through Texas A&M's Transportation Institute about the impact of automated vehicles on the workplace, in particular, possibly on truck drivers moving forward. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, we partnered with the American Center for Mobility and to try to better understand the workforce impacts of automated vehicles moving forward over the next decade. So our study was just focused over the next decade as opposed to some of the other ones that are out that really try to project out 20 to 30 years, which we know is almost impossible
Very
to do.
Hard to do.
You know, thinking about changing legal and economic and social. It's just, you know, it's incredible trying to think out that far. It's hard to even project out 10 years. We conducted a series of focus groups and interviews with industry stakeholders around the country to talk to them about how their organizations are moving forward in terms of AVs and what they see as the impacts on the workforce within their organizations and across the United States in particular. And what our study shows is that, you know, there's a lot of hype in the media about, you know, every trucker is going to lose their jobs. All the taxi drivers are going to lose their jobs. Our study suggests that at least over the next decade, the impacts on jobs are not going to be that substantial. In particular, truckers are not going to be as hard hit as our taxi drivers, we project. Even towards the end of the decade, we're looking at most in taxi drivers around 40%. Dissemination in terms of AVs. Truck drivers should be much lower than that. Our participants said that, you know, if you think about trucking, you have to think about the cargo that those trucks are carrying. So long distance truckers, you know, are really what we're focusing on here. And, you know, that freight can be incredibly expensive. And most companies are not going to want to just leave that to an automated system to make sure that nothing happens to that freight. And so our participants suggested that instead of truck drivers, we'll have truck operators. And so they'll do a variety of different tasks. They'll still be in the vehicles, but they may not be driving. Mm-hmm. And so we project that at least over the next decade, there's going to be very little displacement right. In terms of jobs.
For right, and wouldn't be driving on the highway from point to point, but probably would be driving once the truck got off the exit and needed to get to its actual destination. So as you noted, maybe not a truck driver, but a truck operator performing different tasks as it's moving along the highway and then taking over once you're hitting local streets.
Different technologies have different effects on the labor force. When electronic switching came in, essentially all of the mostly women who had been phone operators, Mabel, get me 3447, all of them lost their jobs. And it was predicted that that would happen to bank tellers when the ATMs came in. But that didn't happen, and that's because bank tellers do things other than just the things that are done by an ATM. And what you're saying is that truck drivers do a lot of things other than just operate the vehicle.
Yes, that's completely true. And you know, if you think about the technology that's evolving so that the automated vehicles actually work, it's a lot cheaper to have somebody in that vehicle that can troubleshoot than to just to have a remote person who may end up having to send out help if there is a problem. And so whether it's taking care of the cargo, whether it's doing that last mile navigation, whether it's, you know, documenting different hazards, whether it's resetting computer systems, there are a range of different activities that our participants suggested that individuals in the trucks would actually still need to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and I agree with your point. You know, over time, you know, as technology evolves, we're always, the media in particular, is saying, oh, this is going to lead to the demise of society, whether it's the automobile way back when, whether it's television, whether it's mobile phones, whether it's automated vehicles. And, you know, as I say over and over to reporters, you know, it depends on how people are using them. You know, it's not, it's not going to be a savior. It's not going to kill a certain group. It's really depends on how they're being used, how they're being deployed, and, you know, the costs, too, come into play, certainly with automated vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Well, when this part of the country was first settled by descendants of Europeans 200 years ago, most people were farm workers. And that's because the average farm worker could only produce enough food to feed four or five people. Now, improvements in agricultural technology mean that only a small fraction of our labor force is involved in agriculture. And I think most people think that's probably a good thing and not a bad thing, even though there was a transition as the amount of employment in agriculture went down. And we're seeing, we're going to see something similar, a transition, but with many good effects as well as the difficult transitional effects.
And our study also suggested that there's going to be thousands of new jobs that will be created as AVs continue to be developed and disseminated. There's going to be a huge need for computer scientists and engineers that can really understand the complexity of the systems and how they operate together. You know, our participants told us over and over again, I can't hire enough people that have the skills that combine those areas right now. And when I do hire them, another company steals them away for twice what I'm paying them. Right. And so it's a challenge both at the most high, you know, the higher levels of education in terms of graduate degrees and understanding these systems and how they work together. But it's also going to be a challenge at the lower levels, you know, with individuals coming out of high school, for example. You may or may not be aware, but there's a drastic shortage in truck drivers right now. Mm-hmm. The average age of a truck driver is like 50, 52.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not quite as cool to be a truck driver as it was like 20 to 30 years ago. And so there's a challenge getting individuals to go into that pipeline, if you will. And so I think as automated technologies continue to evolve, that we can start to market truck driving differently, or truck operation, if you will, differently to individuals coming out of high school or coming out of community colleges. Because if you focus on the technology and the, you know, the cool aspects of automation, maybe it'll be more appealing to younger generations that are coming out.
Well, I remember, you know, I think the talent shortage, we hear a lot about it. Manufacturers in this state, especially advanced manufacturers, but it spans across the disciplines. And, you know, trying to attract young people into these kinds of professions. I remember working with a group from agriculture industry where it just so happens there have been many studies that talk about the use of drones now in the agriculture industry. So, you know, we have to pull off the 16 and 17-year-old person who's playing video games and says, you know, you want to continue to play video games and fly drones? Go and check out a career in agriculture, because they're using them for everything from seeding to fertilizing. I mean, you know, it's no longer the single wind, a single engine propeller plane that's going to fertilize the fields anymore. It's going to be drones, and those drones are going to need to be flown by various by people who understand the technologies. And I fully agree with your statement that there are going to be new jobs created. We don't even know what they are yet. You know, and I'm always reminded, I can't remember the name of the movie, I think that came out last year, about the three African-American scientists, the women at NASA in the early stages of the space program. And I'm reminded of one scene in that movie where NASA gets its first IBM mainframe computer. And one of the female scientists sees the computer and realizes that her group of coders that have been doing it by hand is soon to be extinct. And she adapts them to use the mainframe computer and to learn how to use that mainframe computer. And that's, you know, we don't even know the jobs that are going to be available. We do know that we're going to need people that have those skill sets to be adaptable and flexible to those new jobs.
That sort of fits in with what we were talking about earlier, because clearly there's very strong demand for people with high skill. And that means that the wages and the earnings of people who have those skills are doing very well. We've got to do more to get the bottom half of our population to have the skills to be able to compete for those jobs. I've got a question for you, Sheila. So my parents, they're both still living, thank goodness. They're 91 years old. My mom's eyesight got to the point about a decade ago where she couldn't drive anymore. And then my dad gave up driving 4 or 5 years ago. So, I'm looking forward to when I'm in my 80s, I might just not be physically able to drive. Will I be able to have a vehicle where I can get around on my own without asking somebody for help, but just by punching in some numbers?
Hopefully so. You know, it remains to be determined at this point in time. You know, I will say that one of the biggest stressors for older adults is giving up driving.
Yes.
You know, and so we need to figure out ways to make mobility easier for older adults. But we have to think about, too, that older adults often have different health conditions that arise that may, you know, result in not driving. But there may be other health conditions, too, that impact how mobile they are just in terms of getting in or out of a vehicle, whether they're driving or not. And so one of the things that a couple of colleagues, one in engineering and one in, planning and I are doing are trying to understand different groups that have different disabilities and how that will impact the types of vehicles that they need, specifically in terms of AAVs.
Right.
Because if companies aren't thinking about individuals with disabilities, they're missing a big segment of the population. I don't know if you know, but we're in what's known as a silver tsunami at this point in time. Mm-hmm. There are more people turning 65 every single day in the U.S. than there have ever been at any point in our history.
Well, in Michigan, there are more people turning 65 than there are 18.
Yes.
As well. So we're
and this
aging
is
quickly.
Projected to continue over the next 20, 30, 40 years in particular.
Yes.
And so if companies that aren't developing autonomous vehicles aren't thinking about this population, it's going to be a challenge for older adults to be able to, you know, either use their phone or, you know, have some other way that they can signal that they need an autonomous vehicle. Much of my work is focused on helping older adults to be able to use technologies to cross the technical or what we refer to as the digital divide. Technology use is increasing among older adults in general. So they're a lot more tech savvy than they used to be, but there's still a significant segment of older adults that don't use smartphones.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about, you know, Uber, mm-hmm. Lyft, you have to hail it through your smartphone, through an app on your smartphone or your tablet. And so we have to think about not just the vehicles themselves, but also about how you access those vehicles and helping older adults and people in general be comfortable with those different mechanisms. And so you can't just put it out there and think that people will come
right.
if they don't understand how to actually use the technology to be able to, you know, reach out to the autonomous vehicles.
Well, I think you bring up a great point, certainly in terms of making sure that various segments of the population, older Americans, those with disabilities, know how to use the technology, not just to order a vehicle like Uber and Lyft, but to order their groceries, to order, you know, everyday household supplies that you can now do and get delivered to your door. These kinds of services are going to become even more important to those populations moving forward, but they're going to have to know how to access them, and that's going to be critical.
You know, and I think this brings up another issue, too, that we haven't really talked about, which is cybersecurity. You know, and I've done some work in the past with others at MSU looking at generational differences in how individuals think about and use different devices for online banking, online security issues. And I can tell you that there are more and more people that are trying to take advantage of vulnerable populations. And this is just another venue where that's going to be a likelihood, whether it's hacking into the automated vehicles themselves or whether it's, you know, coming up with fake apps and so forth and marketing it to older adults or to vulnerable groups. I think we have to do a lot of education to help people in general understand some of the challenges. The data that we have from the State of the State survey, we looked at perceived risk and benefits of AVs in particular across generational groups. And one of the things that we found was that across the different age groups, from boomers, you know, younger adults, all the way up to the silent generation, those in their 70s, 80s, and beyond, is that there are still significant concerns about using autonomous vehicles in the future. One of the big concerns is being on the roads with vehicles who are not autonomous, you know. And we know that people keep their vehicles, on average, it's around 13 years now. And so even if today, you know, everyone bought a or leased or used an autonomous vehicle, you'd still have a huge segment of the population that didn't have autonomous vehicles. And so the mixture of autonomous and non-autonomous is worrisome for
And that will be true for decades.
For decades to come. Other concerns, particularly for older adults, were about cybersecurity, about somebody hacking into the vehicles, and you know, how could the car respond? You know, are they going to be left stranded beside the road when you know, if they're not mobile, they can't get out? You know, sometimes, and they're stuck. What do they do? You know, so I think there are a lot of challenges. Now, they did see certainly some benefits, you know, increased mobility potential, the opportunity to stay engaged with significant others, a range of different things like that. But I think our society and the companies in particular who are developing autonomous vehicles have to do some education if they're really going to make these vehicles appealing to generations across the life course.
Well, I certainly appreciate the work that you and others across campus are doing. I've had an opportunity myself to be involved in these discussions, from engineering to planning, as you've noted, to our College of Law. MSU presents a unique opportunity for the study of automated vehicles in particular, given what I like to say our closed campus situation. And, you know, between the hours of 10 to 2 on any given day, the center of our campus might as well resemble Midtown Manhattan. And plus, so you have a continuum of urban and suburban and even rural areas within the MSU campus that make it a natural test bed for these kinds of things. So appreciate the work that you're doing. Pleased that the Institute can be of assistance through our Mapper program, and looking forward to additional research from you and your colleagues. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Charlie, any last words?
Well, I think if we've learned anything from this, we're going to have an interesting few years ahead of us. Lots of change. I mean, it's one of the big stories of our lifetime is the rapid pace of technological change, and the technology appears to be moving faster in many cases than our political systems and our social relationships are able to keep up. And so that's going to be, I think, nobody believes that's going to slow down. It's going to be a continuing challenge for the foreseeable future.
And continuing opportunities as well.
Challenges and opportunities.
Yeah. Well, once again, thank you, Dr. Cotton. Thank you, Charlie. Always a pleasure. That's about all the time we have for today. Appreciate also the folks here, our partners at WKAR. This is Arnold Weinfeld. Join us next time on State of the State.